The ACN podcast is made possible thanks to the generosity of our listeners and sponsors, including the Agile Alliance. As a nonprofit membership organization, the Agile Alliance is an excellent resource to help you along your Agile journey. To learn more about the Agile Alliance and our other sponsors, as well as how you can become a sponsor or supporter of our show, please visit acnpodcast.org for more information. And thank you for your support. This is Ray Orell, and this is the Agile Coaching Network. I'm looking down the list of people who are joining. I see some people who are consistently here month to month, and I just want to go off and just say I really appreciate the people who come to the live event and participate in this. As most of you know, if you've been to the Agile Coaching Network before, this particular podcast and live event is brought to you by the Agile Alliance. The Agile Alliance is a nonprofit organization that's built upon members, and members have really driven Agile into existence across the industry. And if you look at, you know, the participation of any of the things, if you go up to agilealliance.org, you'll find just a wealth of information. This is their 20th year anniversary as an organization. I've worked with them closely as a practitioner, as also I've been a part of that organization as well as both a volunteer and also as an insider in there. And I just know that they have a deep passion for making sure that the industry is moving forward well with Agile. And the way that that's done is through what we do as volunteers and what we do as members, because you can always just do your, you know, pay your dues, you know, and that helps the organization to fund a lot of the great things that they're doing. And as you know, if you go up to the website, Agile 2022 is coming up shortly. Pleased to announce that we are going to be doing our first physical business agility lab that we've been doing there for about the last 5 years. We haven't been able to do it for the last couple of years because of course the COVID and the other situations, but we will actually be live and be together doing alongside of all the great talks and the keynotes. We will actually have a dedicated room where we're going to be talking about business agility and working with cohorts to go over what are the things that you might be seeing in your own companies. And we're going to have a really great set of facilitators that'll be there. And I hope that you get a chance to come to Nashville and be a part of that. It's not on the program yet, but you'll see that hit on the program shortly. And it'll be absolutely fun. We're joined with a cast of regulars that join us every month. They're the conversation starters. They help to get us talking as a group. What makes this different, not just the insight of Diana or Shauna or Hendrik or Jorg or even myself. I mean, we definitely can spend an hour talking about the subjects that we have, but what we really want to hear is hear from you. This is a group of coaches and people trying to be involved with Agile and Agile practices. Even if you're new to Agile, the perspective that you bring is a good one, because for those of us who've been doing it for a while, we might not remember how it was when we were first starting off with Agile and Agile development. So might be 10 years ago, and you might bring a fresh perspective that we might not be seeing any longer. So we definitely want to hear from you on this. So to kick this off, I've had a lot of conversations over the last several months, actually, on something that coaches hit all the time. And I think for a group, it would be vital for us to actually spend and have a conversation with this. And that is, if you think of that cartoon that's up that you see online sometimes, where it shows the two people that they're pushing a cart and the cart has square wheels. And as a change agent, you have the capacity, or you have the tools and other different things that to make people's lives easier. So let's just say you have a round wheel that's in your hand, and you're trying to get people to put on the round wheel and take off the square wheel. But people say, no thanks, we're too busy to go and do that process improvement. And I'm curious, as a coach, how do we deal with this situation? And that's where I want to kick off the conversation today. Diana, have you ran into this?
Well, of course I've run into this.
I know that was a goofy question, I know.
Yeah, I want to find the coach who's not run into this, actually. It seems, I don't know, what, contagious or infectious. It's all over the place. And as somebody who's closely associated with the practice of retrospectives, I may hear about it even more than some of the others, because people get pushback against taking the time to stop and reflect on how their work has been going and figure out whether what they can learn from that, and if any of their learnings tell them to, you know, do something different, improve in some way. And so absolutely, I run into this. But there are a number of factors, though, that I find that come up. Some of it is just in the people, you know, the individual team members. They're either their personality or their history or whatever. They're just somebody who feels like they just need to keep moving forward. They keep moving forward. And for those folks, I talk about how the universe is built on what we call the Baker's transform in complexity theory. Stretch and fold, which is also breathe in, breathe out, breathe in, breathe out. And when we are trying to stay busy, 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 and never stopping to reflect or think about how we might do things better, it's as if we're trying to just breathe in, breathe in, breathe in, breathe in, breathe in, breathe in, breathe in. And of course, we die then, right? We need this back and forth. And it's certainly central to any learning that we need to do. We need to stop. Stephen Covey called it sharpening the saw. And so I have collected over time a whole boatload of those kinds of analogies and metaphors that I can bring up to, you know, bring up whichever one I think is going to resonate most with this particular team member or this particular team group. Oftentimes, though, the too busy to improve is coming from outside the team. The team knows they would do better if they could stop and take a breath and you know, figure out how to do something better, or they already have ideas, but the people around them, their leadership, their managers, maybe their product owner, are saying, no, we can't do that. You got to keep moving forward. And in those cases, I feel like it's my job as a coach to become the liaison, to begin talking to those other folks about how they are actually impeding progress with those directives, with saying you can't take time to think, you can't take time for a stand-up meeting, can't possibly take time for a retrospective. You know, no planning, just do, right? And it's a road to ruin, right? And so sometimes as coaches, we need to be those folks who go to the stakeholders, the influencers in the organization, and say, you know, this isn't going to work out well for you. You are not going to get the outcomes you want in this way. And let's talk about why that is and how you can do things better and so on. It's often linked to the wanting people to be 100% utilized and those kinds of things. And there's some amazing, wonderful stories. I particularly love Mary Poppendick's, you know, a fully utilized freeway becomes a parking lot. Nobody goes anywhere, right? And mm-hmm. We talk about that with slack time. So these are closely associated ideas, the slack and the taking time to improve and learning hours, taking time to learn. And I feel like as a coach, we're not just focused on the team. We have that responsibility to liaise with other people in the organization who have an impact on how the team can get their work done.
Right. And just to kind of expand on what you're saying, because I've seen the exact same thing where if you look at, you know, we'll pick on Scrum for a second. If you follow Scrum correctly, they say that you never go commit 100% of your capacity to your sprint. You should always have slack in the system so that if something comes up, or in the event that you we need to go fund, you know, these improvement efforts, you know, through what you develop and do, that you have the time to do that. And there's been debates where I've seen some people say, well, I need to go put my improvement on my backlog, or I never get it done. But I think that's because that's that capacity planning issue that's there. So I'm just curious that when you're seeing somebody stuck like that, because we work from influence as coaches, you know, we try to influence people and say, hey, you know, if you try this might get a little bit better for you, you know. And I think Steve was writing something in the question box. He was saying something about, well, give it, you know, 15 minutes, or give it some period of time where, you know, throughout someone's day, it's just as a reminder, and that we should be highlighting these things. And I know you're going to probably give me the consultant's answer of sometimes it depends, but what has been the most powerful tool that you've had to reflect back, not just for the team, but to go remove the impediment with management?
To answer your question about what, because Agile is a pull system, right? And if we have a team that thinks they're too busy to improve, they've missed like the most in like the top three things about Agile. The fact that it's an empirical process. And if we're too busy to improve, we're essentially bolting on waterfall behavior on the Agile process. And sometimes it's really just making them aware of, hey guys, the reason we have retrospectives, the reason we spend so much time grooming and refining our backlog and planning and getting stories ready is so that we could make, you know, quick decisions and deliver value quickly. And then we monitor that based on our Agile metrics, and we see how well we're doing, and we come up with strategies every retrospective to improve. So if we're not doing that, we're essentially waterfall with a bunch of rituals that are actually meetings. And that's not effective. So how do we make this effective? So now, instead of being voluntold that they must do this, now you kind of told them what's in it for them. It's a collaboration. And now they may not be willing to do everything that's necessary to improve, but they're willing to consider some things and adopt some things. And then, you know, within a few iterations, you could potentially change the behavior of that team or that organization.
I like what you're saying there, but just as a clarification, and I've heard people say this before, I have to go ask management to improve my work, or I have to go ask my PO. Do you think that's a bad behavior that people have when they're saying that they don't feel empowered enough to go improve their own workbench?
I mean, that goes against the principles. We're supposed to get motivated people to come together to solve business problems. If they're not empowered because of the stakeholders or the product owners, then there's an executive coaching opportunity for the Agile coach to engage the product owner, to engage a stakeholder, to kind of create the communication either through a guild or through some way to get to bridge the lines of communications to fix that impediment. At least the attempt should be made to fix it outside of the team. But within the team, there are things that they can adopt to improve as a team. Those dependencies that they have outside, or the prioritization that they're getting, if there are issues with that and that's undermining or forcing them not to improve, then something like that could be surfaced in a retrospective and shared with a stakeholder or shared with a product owner. So there are many ways to skin the cat.
Okay, well, let's role play for a second. I'm the product owner who's saying that the team, no, you cannot go do that improvement. I am the product owner, and I am telling you that I do not approve that. How would you approach that with me? I'm curious. What's your coaching style?
I totally understand your hesitation. And in order for me to get a better understanding, because I want to support you as a product owner, you are the empathy officer, you are the chief value deliverer, okay? So I want to make sure that I'm aligned and I don't undermine your value. But let's first think about, what are the reasons you don't want to work on this improvement thing? Let's talk about it. Let's just get a few ideas on the line. Okay, and then I would kind of isolate that. And then I would try to overcome those rebuttals with recommendations. Like if they said, I don't want to do it because it takes too much time. It's like, I totally understand where you're coming from. What if I told you that we would be able to do this in significantly less time than you thought up front. Would that change your mind? So it goes from a no to a maybe. So it's really the conversation. And then now I have these insights from the product owner. I can go back to the team and say, okay, guys, here are the guardrails. These are the things that he's concerned about. These are the things that he's worried about. With this in mind, how do we improve as a team and help the team and the product owner and the stakeholders achieve the vision and business value that we're trying to deliver to our cohorts?
I love it. Thank you. Thank you for that.
Very welcome.
Steve, are you there? What do you have on this?
Yeah, I was just going to expand on what I wrote in the chat there. So 2 points, and this is a very Scrum-centric point of view, so just take that, you know, as a given. I try to remind the team that they have a proportional 13 hours per month of sprint time, and, you know, we can cut all that in half if we do 2-week sprints or whatever. We have 13 hours to have transparency and inspection and adaptation. That's built into the framework. That is your change. And we have 15 minutes every day to do our daily scrum. And that is your time to do transparency and inspection and adaptation for 15 minutes every day. So if you add all that up, that's maybe 15 hours every couple, or, you know, 15 hours a month, or maybe 7 or 8 hours every 2 weeks to do change. So I'm confused when people say we don't have time to change. And then the second part is when they say, you know, how do we change, or maybe we do have time, what do we do next? I say, what is the team's greatest strength? And then leverage that. Like, you know, of the things that this team can do, man, we can deploy fast. We have CI/CD flying. We can deploy to prod in less than a minute. Great. Let's use that to leverage that as much as we can and buy us some time, buy us some slack, using our greatest strength to do those change things.
Love that. Same role playing though. I'm gonna give the same question to you. So I'm the product owner, or I'm the business owner, or someone else. Make your pitch to me. How would you convince them and the team as a coach? How would you go approach that? That no, you can't go do that. That user story that makes you better.
I'm not sure if I understood that at very end of your question. What do you mean by
that part? I'm sorry. We want to go reduce the complexity of the code because we know that's going to help us go faster, but they'll never let us get approval to go do that. So how would you approach that with the team? And then if you do have a product owner that seems to be standing in the middle of the team wanting to go do improvements on the way that they work, how would you go approach that product owner who's standing in the middle saying, no, you shouldn't do that?
Sure. So I'd say, hey, Ray, great to see you today. And the team has noticed that in the past, what we've done is something takes 2 or 3 sprints to get this to you, and you get a little nervous and you start prodding the team. That's our empirical evidence. They've got some ideas for how we could change things and show you small pieces more frequently. We might be able to give you a little demo every 3 or 4 days. And I know your value on this product and what you want out of it. And the team believes, and I think that they're right, that we can show you that value sooner and get your feedback sooner instead of you being nervous for 6 weeks at a time and wondering if it's going to come out okay. You think you might be willing to give that a shot as an experiment. And if that doesn't work out for us, we can always try something else.
Awesome. I love the transparency that you're pitching, because my biggest fear is that you go away for 2 weeks and then I won't get what I need for my customers. So I love that. So thank you for that. I appreciate that, Steve. Let's see, April.
How are you doing?
Doing well. Do you miss me at the Agile Alliance?
I miss you. Yes, I was thinking that I had to be here just to see you.
Hi, April.
Hi.
That's awesome. We're all hugging right now, so just give us a second. Yes. But do you have a approach that you would take when people are telling you that they're too busy to improve?
So common, everyone's that I was having that conversation today and last week and every week. It's a typical conversation. sometimes you may want to ask a question differently. Like, what is it worth to you if you're able to solve for whatever that need is? So you probably want to ask a question before, like, hey, like, what's your biggest, you know, pain? And what is it worth to solve that? And to uncover, ask some questions to kind of uncover, you know, that, and kind of gives them reasons to say, you know, kind of support. I can help you solve that, to improve that. So they can understand how going slow to go fast. I was just speaking about, I had a team where they were like 3 years late on some project, and they didn't have any time to slow down to even think about what they're doing, where a lot of the work that they were doing, because they were so busy, they had to get these emergent things done, all of them, like over 95% of them could have been automated. They took, and it didn't take that long to automate. It took them less than a week to automate all these different things, and they had so much breath to fix it. So sometimes they just need a moment to think, as Diana said, to retrospect, to put that out there. So I try to ask questions based upon their need, not me trying to solve it for them, but for them to solve it for themselves.
That's awesome. I love that perspective. You know, give me 1% improvement a week, you know, just experiment with it. I've been accused in the past of trying to boil the ocean. You know, try first just to, you know, do a couple of different things that just make life a little bit better, you know, each sprint. And then I've also noticed that if we make an improvement, how do you re-spend that capacity? Do you spend it on more product features, which is one option, but you can also spend it on working on bigger things as well. Kathy, you've had your hand up for a little bit. What do you have on this?
So there's a couple things. One of them, obviously, I have developers who want to change the world and do a lot of new things, but that's not always an option. But what I do like to do is get more clarity of what they really want to focus on. And if they have that clarity, then it's easier to bring it to someone and say, this is what we want to do, and this is how it will improve whatever. And then I go back to the planning session for the iteration and try to reserve that 20% to make the system better. And if that's making the developers happy and still delivering what the product owner needs, we have a win-win.
Mm-hmm. And just curious about what metrics would you track in order to show that, you know, increased capacity or however that you are actually seeing improvement in the team?
That would partly be determined with what they were going to do. Let's say, for example, what they did, they said this is going to make a performance improvement. Then I would get the metrics in advance of what the performance is, and then afterwards be able to show, here's the improvement we had from this work that we did that's taken us the last 3 iterations to complete.
Awesome. And you do you typically, I've noticed that crisis sometimes is a great change agent within the system.
Yep.
So do you ever like take advantage of like some big issue and then insert
we
change
did.
There?
Yes. I had a product owner that was no, my work has to be the only thing they're doing because this other stuff is going to take too long. And really what it was we had database was outdated as far as maintenance. So the company that supported the database was going to tell us next time anything happened, sorry, update your system and then it'll be fine. So we went to the product owner and we talked to him. Actually, I talked to him and I said, okay, here's the problem. If this database goes down, we're out of production. We cannot do anything because we have no system support any longer. If you do not see clear to be able to do this upgrade on the database, then you are taking that responsibility, and we will make it so that everybody is aware we're doing these other things. We have no choice and we'll get to the database as soon as possible. But if anything happens in the meantime, you have denied what we absolutely have to get done to support the system. Because sometimes the responsibility has to be where it's at. If the product owner will not let us work on the system at all, we have no choice but let the product owner have that responsibility.
Oh, interesting. I like how you reverse that onto them. Hey, it's a business continuity issue. I know we believe in business continuity around this place, right? So I like that. That is a really good approach. Jörg, welcome. Hopefully you're having a good month. What do you have on this?
Thank you. Yes, I'm having a good month. It's rather busy. That delayed me. Sorry for that.
No problem.
Too busy to improve. That's how I deal with that. I always try to look for the reason of the improvement and then try to make that goal, that benefit, that need small enough to be easy to accommodate. So instead of putting everything into one big thing, do small improvements as often as possible and make them feel just natural. Because very often that gives the continuity a positive attitude to improvement that very much makes things easier for people. But it's really like vertical slicing of other problems. It's something you need to practice a long time with the team for them to really, really get good and independent and not notice. The time for this is normally always there. The point is not where I don't have the time. The question is when do I spend the time? And so the minimum time always has to be spent sooner or later. Try to make it available in chunks.
Now, I've been lucky enough to actually sit in a room with you over in Germany and watch the way that you work. I noticed that you had a real knack for empowering people, you know, with being able to, you know, have them own their work. So I'm curious that as a person, at the time, I think you were a manager of the group. Is that correct?
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
So how did you, as a manager in role modeling that, how did you potentially go off and role model that to other managers to say, or other product owners and other people to act and behave like you? I'm just kind of curious, what was your approach?
Yeah, probably three things I did with the management teams that were really interested. I actually made them practice retrospectives just straightforward. Let's see what is our expectation for the next 2 weeks, even though we're not doing Scrum, any method, anything, but let's be conscious, decide what we want to do. And then in 2 weeks, let's take some time and reflect. How did we do? What was good? What was bad? And the most important point is always, what do we want to keep and where do we want to reinforce success? And that is the thing when you're in a positive environment, then this is simple. If people feel they are the most important person just because they are a manager, then there are two things that I try to do. One is actually tell them the stories of success and make it feel natural to them that people are improving and that this is giving them a benefit, because at least then they are no longer resisting when things happening within the teams, but they are starting to find the things that they can share upwards as success. Instead of saying we found a problem, we've removed that problem. And if it would have hit us at the customer, that would have cost us whatever amount of time, money, and material, and just make that story believable. Don't overscale. You get a lot of attention with these ones. And other than that, I try to just share my own learnings and by that drive them to understand that actually they need to have that experience. And once whoever picks up a goal and tries to improve on that one sees that it's not something to be easily pushed away if you really want it. And that's share it and be vulnerable enough to show where you need to improve and where you need to learn and how stupid you are on a lot of things.
It's not, no, you just, there's opportunities. There's always opportunities.
Honestly speaking, I'm making a lot of mistakes, very, very many. And if I'm not acknowledging this, I'm making myself weaker. So that's...
That's actually a good perspective. So, I mean, transparency is a great, you know, if we're going to use that word, fail publicly. You'd say, hey, look, this is what I did. I remember that we had an executive one time. He was retiring and he was up on stage and he shares this story about how he made this really huge mistake. And I remember all of us in the audience just going, oh my goodness, this person's human. We didn't think he was human before, but now that he's sharing this, and we all wish that he would have shared that story 4 years ago, 5 years ago, you know, so yeah. We weren't all just running around. Diana. Yeah,
right. There's just a quick interjection here. There's a wonderful management consultant, organizational complexity person named Chip Bell. He used to write a lot. I don't know how old he is now, but he used to write a lot for a Harvard Business Review, and he's written books and things. And he had this great phrase for leaders, learn out loud. So, you know, do exactly what you were just describing with your executive. You know, that's learning out loud. Here's what happened to me. Wow, I needed to learn something that I didn't already know. And so I'm sharing with you how I learned to do better or to change or whatever it is. And I just love that phrase, learn out loud. So I just wanted to interject that here.
Go ahead, Derek.
Just to add to this, I've made the experience that if you don't learn, the same things happen to you again. And that sometimes even makes the better story, that actually you failed to learn once and now you're learning again and you don't do it a third time. Because then actually there is included the fact that nobody's perfect, and actually that sometimes you miss the learning opportunity and try to avoid it. But awesome. It's happening.
Yeah, so I was just listening all the communication about the team improvement and really, you know, like to share something here.
Please.
I really work as an agile coach, and when I use my retrospective, I always try to look a 0.5% improvement. So I'm not looking for any big bang things to improve, any big process to improve, because it would be too much for the team. And that's not their primary goal when they look it from that development perspective. But if you look at 0.5 every sprint and having 26 sprint in a year, let's say we rounded up to 20, assuming vacation time and everything, the 0.5 would turn out to be a 10%, much better numbers. And when we discuss something, we try to find out something as an actionable item, which probably could be observed within the next sprint and see how we are progressing. So such thing really help us to improve rather than creating a big process change, which, you know, going for things here and there and identifying how the things would go from this direction to that direction. Such things really, really help us out.
Cool. Yeah, no, I think that's a really great point, which is, you know, small wins over a period of time. That's beautiful. I love it.
And I even requested them to, if something is actionable item, they would like to make it visible, push it to the product backlog and see if we can, you know, get it observed so that it won't be looked as something they are working behind the scene, or it will not be accounted for. So it's making everything transparent and visible. Any small even process change, let's say I would like to have these things to be done in this way. Okay, what will happen if I will do that? And the main another way of looking is how I can remove a lot of wastage happening within the process. That is also another way to improve. Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you for that. Paula, did you have something to add to this?
I was, when we were talking about, the leaders having vulnerability and showing there when they've dropped the, when they've had some some failures, that I'm a big proponent of psychological safety, right? You're not going to get any innovation until you're way into, that level of safety where you feel safe to contribute. And if we're still at that stumbling block where we're trying to give people that safety to learn, that safe to fail, right? Nobody learns anything from succeeding. That is quite, and of course I'm an employee of the company that I'm a coach for, right? So I'm not coming in as an outsider, right? I have built these relationships with our business partners and with our IT, leadership, that, that is that thing we're trying to do, right? Where I'm trying to spread that multiplier culture where, it's better to make everybody on the team 1% smarter than just you being 10% smarter. And so that's how I do an awful lot of modeling and talking about, learning and making everything, because we're not boiling the ocean, right? We've got to make that 1%, that marginal gain, understanding that we're doing that out. We're not looking for output, we're looking for outcomes, right?
Right, right. So I'm kind of curious, you bringing up in safe to fail, it took to bring that into companies that I've worked in. It took a little bit to go create that safe environment. So if you were in an environment where trust is low in an organization, what would be your first steps, even as an internal coach, in order to go create that environment where it is safe to be able to make mistakes or fail?
I think it's all relationship building, right? You've got to you even do it that, you don't have to go all the way to the top, right? You just need to get it at your immediate, are you, because I have workplaces where that delegated authority isn't there, right? There has to be a trust that your product owner is being trusted to provide the value in the sprint, that you trust that your team are doing the right thing, right? We're not just, where this is not the age of putting the developers in a room, feeding them under the door, here go code monkey, where's my code, right? That this is, that there's always, I think, that transparency and communication, right? And I still fight the battle of, smallest slice of largest functionality, right? Are we solving for a need? I have created allies amongst other parts of the business, right? I have people on the design, in the design part of the building business, that's talking about those, shortening the feedback loops, getting that communication, right? Because you only have to give them one win, right? You give that, if you can just, like, here, we're going to do this experiment, we're going to show you this thing, and then we're going to release it, right? Let us give you a small slice, because as I say all the time, we might make it and gold plate it and make coffee and ice cream, and come to find out our customers just need the light to turn red. And we wasted all this time making it make coffee and ice cream, and that's not what it needed.
That is a good way of putting it. And ice cream, now I'm hungry.
Sorry.
That's okay. There's actually, if you get a chance, there's and you can go see a YouTube video of this individual, but Benjamin Zander, I think I got his last name correctly, but he's a conductor of the Boston Philharmonic, and he talks about his attitude towards problems, and he's a firm believer that there isn't really failure. He says the word failure itself is, if you ever said the word I failed, he says, watch people's bodies and how they react. They, you know, your chest kind of caves in, you kind of bend over, I failed, you know, and your oxygen leaves your body. And his whole point is that when a mistake happens, he says that you should just say, how fascinating. And he does it with great, you know, enthusiasm about, you know, how fascinating it was that that happens. And I was thinking back in my contrast in my Fortune 100 days, you know, when we do all this great test and we do all this great design and great coding patterns and everything else that we go off and go do, and then a defect gets out and we go, oh, and we're all like filled demoralized that that defect got passed through several million dollars worth of test equipment and people. And I just thought his attitude is sort of like, well, and I adopted this myself as a manager and as a leader, is that if something got past all of that, I do find that fascinating. I find that that's kind of curious how that snuck out there, because I know someone didn't make a mistake. The last component I just want to add to it is that attitudes towards problems, and I think this is leadership as well as coaching, is that when problems are occurring, if you're negative about what people are bringing to you, you have a high degree of negativity that's there. People tend to hide data from you, you know, or if you're neutral about it, then they're passive. Versus if you're positive, like, you know, like that conductor, then you can have a conversation about it. And I think it becomes really, really powerful from that.
If I may, that is actually what I would like to add to the how do I start building psychological safety, that is by curiosity. Because if I approach somebody wanting to know something, then this is a rather safe zone. He doesn't need to tell me, but he can. And then if I'm really taking this up correlated to my experience, this is matching what I've seen, this is totally new, tell me more. That gets a conversation going that is normally very authentic, very true, and very often finds points to help to get going, to start and to address the things that are really on the minds of the people you want to help. So always being curious and ask open questions, it's a good start. And sometimes if you feel like you failed and you're in that negative mood, just share it that you feel bad about this. It's totally different to this thing is bad. I feel bad about it. I should have known, or something is different from you failed.
Right. I agree with that. I think Richard just typed in, he says, as you know, as being new to a development team, what are the best ways to encourage teams to celebrate failure as they go along? And also, how do we capture that learning as well? I'll give one thing that we did, and others can chime in on this as well. We used to have literally a wall of failure, and it was in our team room. It was this big wall that had stories that people wrote about what might have went wrong, and those stories were all posted in the middle, and it said, you know, it did say this was a failure. But then from that, there were stories about how that became knowledge and learning. You know, how do we take it forward? And we always brought new employees in front of that board and say, look, if you want to read about us, about the good things that we've done and also these things, you know, go ahead and read them. And there would be like senior, you know, principal people with stories up there, and also junior people as well. But I think that gave the impression to people that it's okay. It's okay to have these stories and to share them. How about others? Do you have that similar attitude or some process that you put in place?
I try to shake up my retros, right? And one of the ones I believe came from Fun Retrospectives, I don't know. It was the celebration grid, right? Where we talk about, it's like, here's like success and here's failure. And here's like, here, we lucked into it. We did it on purpose, or we followed our process and, you know, what did we learn, right? Quite often it is that phrasing. You're right. It's the phraseology of failure. It's like, because you're, when you keep saying there's a problem, and we use problems strictly as the thing we are trying to, it is the thing, it's that pain point that our customers brought. The problem is the pain point the customers brought to us that we need to solve, right? Versus, you know, our solution, if there is a failure or a learn, you know, it's like, what did we learn, right? It's that quite often you start with that, okay, this didn't work. Well, what did we learn, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's always, if you're always phrasing that as a learning opportunity, and we do talk about that fail thing, but we don't use the word fail very often. We talk about fail fast, but then we never talk about failure when they actually, when something doesn't work, right? We're like, mm-hmm. okay, this is what happened. Here's, you know, the test, here's our red, right? Our test failed. I mean, and what did we learn? How did we change it? What did we do? How do we move forward? How do we not do this again? Are all the conversations that are now naturally happening. But I think we build that, that's built on that underlayer of trust and empowerment that we have, we've given, right? Everybody feels safe to come forward and say, yeah, this didn't work. Because I just worked with some consultants, like, and it, they hit it, right? Every time something didn't work, they hit it from me. And I was so used to trusting my team that I wasn't prepared to deal with people who were hiding things from us.
Wow. That how did you sense that out? Just, you know, we have a few minutes left. I just want, how did you figure that out? Yeah.
I actually, my senior tech lead, who was kind of supervising their work or peer check, or, you know, approving the PRs, was like, yeah, none of this stuff is ever, you know, I was like being told this is done, this is happening, everything's beautiful. And he's like, nobody's checked in a PR yet. And I'm like, well, what the what? And I had to go find that old project manager hat that I don't enjoy, that command and control, and had to like start stepping on necks. And that was not a pleasant experience. And I don't like doing that. No, right. I'm much more of a, you know, my number one strength is individualization, right? I'm all about everybody getting to know what makes them them and how I can make them better thems, right? Don't you love right. that not English I speak? And so, you know, I'm perpetually, you know, in touch with my people, all of my team members, right? I've got that platinum rule with all of them, right? How do they, you know, how do they want to be treated? How do they learn? How do we get the best response out of them? But that's all about that relationship and transparency.
Right. Absolutely. Thank you for that. Well, awesome. So as everyone knows, and just to wrap up really quick, Agile 2022, the registration is open. Please go up there if you're going to attend. We'd love to have you. And then other than that, the next live event is going to be on Friday, April 29th. I think I have that day correctly. And in the meantime, I hope that you all have an outstanding month. This podcast is provided by Agile Alliance for educational and informative purposes only. To find out more information about the member-supported Agile Alliance, please go to agilealliance.org to find out about more upcoming events, as well as different programs that are available to help you with your Agile journey.